Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's Fiction Podcast. I'm EQMM's editor, Janet Hutchings. As most but possibly not all of our listeners will know, Ellery Queen was a pseudonym of the multi-talented writing team of Frederick Dene and Manfred B. Lee. They authored 36 novels and many dozen more short stories under that pseudonym. Together, they also produced radio plays and founded Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, which they sent to the world under the editorship of Dene himself in 1941. As part of our 2021 celebration, the magazine's 80th anniversary, we're presenting a reading of one of my favorite Ellery Queen stories, one whose timing seems just right since the birthday of George Washington was just days ago. Here is EQMM's managing editor Jackie Sherbo reading The President's Half Dime by Ellery Queen.
Those few curious men who have chosen to turn off the humdrum highway to hunt for their pleasure along the back trails expect, indeed, they look confidently forward to, many strange encounters. And it is the dull stalk which does not turn up at least a hippogriff. But it remained for Ellery Queen to experience the ultimate excitement. On one of his prowls, he collided with a President of the United States. This would have been joy enough if it had occurred, as you might imagine, by chance, on a dark night, in some back street of Washington, D.C., with Secret Service men closing in on the delighted Mr. Queen to question his motives by way of his pockets, while a large, black, bulletproof limousine rushed up to spirit the powerless president away. But mere imagination fails in this instance. What is required is the power of fancy, for the truth is fantastic. Ellery's encounter with the President of the United States took place not on a dark night, but in the unromantic light of several days, although the night played its role too. Nor was it by chance. The meeting was arranged by a farmer's daughter, and it was not in Washington, D.C., for this president presided over the affairs of the nation from a different city altogether. Not that the meeting took place in that city either. It did not take place in a city at all, but on a farm some miles south of Philadelphia. Oddest of all, there was no limousine to spirit the chief executive away, for while the president was a man of great wealth, he was still too poor to possess an automobile and, what is more, not all the resources of his government, indeed not all the riches of the world, could have provided one for him. There are even more curious facets to this jewel of paradox. This was an encounter in the purest sense, and yet, physically, it did not occur at all. The president in question was dead. And while there are those who would not blink at a rubbing of shoulders or a clasping of hands, even though one of the parties was in his grave, and to such persons, the thought might occur that the meeting took place on a psychic plane. Alas, Ellery Queen is not of their company. He does not believe in ghosts. Consequently, he never encounters them. So he did not collide with the president's shade either. And yet their meeting was as palpable as, say, the meeting between two chess masters, one in London and the other in New York, who never leave their respective armchairs and still play a game to a decision. It is even more wonderful than that, for while the chess players merely annihilate space, Ellery and the father of his country annihilated time. A century and a half of it. In fine, this is the story of how Ellery Queen matched wits with George Washington. Those who are finicky about their fashions complain that the arms of coincidence are too long, but in this case, the designer might say that he cut to measure, or, to put it another way, an event often brews its own mood. Whatever the cause, the fact is that the adventure of the president's half dime, which was to concern itself with the events surrounding President Washington's 59th birthday, actually first engrossed Ellery on February 19th and culminated 3 days later. Ellery was in his study that morning, wrestling with several reluctant victims of violence, none of them quite flesh and blood, since his new novel was still in the planning stage. So he was annoyed when Nikki came in with a card. "James Ezekiel Patch," growled the great man. He was never in his best humor during the planning stage. "I don't know any James Ezekiel Patch, Nikki. Toss the fellow out and get back to transcribing those notes on possible motives." "Why, Ellery," said Nikki, This isn't like you at all. What isn't like me? To renege on an appointment. Appointment? Does this patch claim? He doesn't merely claim it, he proves it. Someone's balmy, snarled Mr. Queen, and he strode into the living room to contend with James Ezekiel Patch. This, he perceived as soon as James Ezekiel Patch rose from the Queen fireside chair, was likely to be a heroic project. Mr. Patch, notwithstanding his mild, even studious eyes, seemed to rise indefinitely. He was a large, a very large man. Now what's all this? Demanded Ellery fiercely, for after all, Nicky was there. That's what I'd like to know, said the large man amiably. What did you want with me, Mr. Queen? What did I want with you? What did you want with me? I find this very strange, Mr. Queen. Now see here, Mr. Patch, I happen to be extremely busy this morning. So am I. Mr. Patch's large, thick neck was reddening, and his tone was no longer amiable. Ellery took a cautious step backward as his visitor lumbered forward to thrust a slip of yellow paper under his nose. Did you send me this wire, or didn't you? Ellery considered it tactically expedient to take the telegram, although for strategic reasons, he did so with a bellicose scowl. Imperative you call at my home tomorrow, February 19, promptly 10 a.m., signed Ellery Queen. Well, sir? Thundered Mr. Patch. Do you have something on Washington for me, or don't you? Washington, said Ellery absently, studying the telegram. George Washington, Mr. Queen. I'm Patch, the antiquarian. I collect Washington. I'm an authority on Washington. I have a large fortune, and I spend it all on Washington. I'd never have wasted my time this morning if your name hadn't been signed to this wire. This is my busiest week of the year. I have engagements to speak on Washington. Desist, Mr. Patch, said Ellery. This is either a practical joke or the Baroness Check, announced Nicky clearly, with another telegram. And then she added, and Professor John Cecil Shaw, ditto. The three telegrams were identical. Of course I didn't send them, said Ellery thoughtfully, regarding his three visitors. Baroness Check was a short, powerful woman, resembling a dumpling with gray hair, an angry dumpling. Professor Shaw was lank and long-jawed, wearing a sack suit which hung in some places and failed in its purpose by inches at the extremities. Along with Mr. Patch, they constituted as deliciously queer a trio as had ever congregated in the Queen apartment. Their host suddenly determined not to let go of them. On the other hand, someone obviously did, using my name. Then there's nothing more to be said, snapped the Baroness, snapping her bag for emphasis. I should think there's a great deal more to be said, began Professor Shaw in a troubled way, wasting people's time in this way. It's not going to waste any more of my time, growled the large Mr. Patch. Washington's birthday only 3 days off. Exactly, smiled Ellery. Why don't you sit down? There's more in this than meets the eye. Baroness Check, if I'm not mistaken, you're the one who brought the fabulous collection of rare coins into the United States just before Hitler invaded Czechoslovakia. You're in the rare coin business in New York now. Unfortunately, said the Baroness coldly, one must eat. And you, sir, I seem to know you. Rare books, said the professor in the same troubled way. Of course. John Cecil Shaw, the rare book collector. We've met at Mims and other places. I abandoned my first theory. There's a pattern here, distinctly unhumorous. An antiquarian, a coin dealer, a collector of rare books. Nicky, whom have you out there this time? If this one collects anything, muttered Nicky into her employer's ear, I'll bet it has two legs and hair on its chest. A darn pretty girl. Named Martha Clark, said a cool voice, and Ellery turned to find himself regarding one of the most satisfying sights in the world. Ah, I take it, Miss Clark. You also received one of these wires signed with my name. Oh, no, said the pretty girl. I'm the one who sent them. There was something about the comely Miss Clark which inspired, if not confidence, at least an openness of mind. Perhaps it was the self-possessed manner in which she sat all of them, including Ellery, down in Ellery's living room, while she waited on the hearth rug, like a conductor on the podium, for them to settle in their chairs. and it was the measure of Miss Clerk's assurance that none of them was indignant, only curious. "I'll make it snappy," said Martha Clerk briskly. "I did what I did the way I did it because, first, I had to make sure I could see Mr. Patch, Baroness Check, and Professor Shaw today. Second, because I may need a detective before I'm through. Third," she added, almost absently, "because I'm pretty desperate. My name is Martha Clerk. My father Tobias is a farmer. Our farm lies just south of Philadelphia. It was built by a Clark in 1761, and it's been in our family ever since. I won't go gooey on you. We're broke, and there's a mortgage. Unless Papa and I can raise $12,000 in the next couple of weeks, we lose the old homestead." Professor Shaw looked vague, but the Baroness said, "Deplorable, Miss Clerk. Now, if I'm to run my auction this afternoon..." And James Ezekiel Patch grumbled, "If it's money you want, young woman..." "Certainly it's money I want, but I have something to sell." "Ah," said the professor. "Hmm," said the antiquarian. Mr. Queen said nothing, and Miss Porter jealously chewed the end of her pencil. "The other day, while I was cleaning out the attic, I found an old book." "Well, now," said Professor Shaw indulgently, "an old book, eh? It's called The Diary of Simeon Clerk. Simeon Clerk was Papa's great-great-great-something or other. His diary was privately printed in 1792 in Philadelphia, Professor, by a second cousin of his, Jonathan, who was in the printing business there." "Jonathan Clerk, The Diary of Simeon Clerk," mumbled the cadaverous book collector. "I don't believe I know either, Miss Clerk. Have you..." Martha Clerk carefully unclasped a large manila envelope and drew forth a single yellowed sheet of badly printed paper. "The title page was loose, so I brought it along." Professor Shaw silently examined Miss Clerk's exhibit, and Ellery got up to squint at it. "Of course," said the professor, after a long scrutiny in which he held the sheet up to the light and performed other mysterious rites. "Mere age doesn't connote rarity, nor does rarity of itself constitute value. And while this page looks genuine for the purported period, and is rare enough to be unknown to me, still..." "Suppose I told you," said Miss Martha Clerk, "that the chief purpose of the diary, which I have at home, is to tell the story of how George Washington visited Simeon Clark's farm in the winter of 1791. "Clark's farm? 1791? exclaimed James Ezekiel Patch. "Preposterous, there's no record of, and of what George Washington buried there," the farmer's daughter concluded. By executive order, the Queen telephone was taken off its hook, the door was bolted, the shades were drawn, and the long interrogation began. By the middle of the afternoon, the unknown chapter in the life of the father of his country was fairly sketched. Early on an icy gray February morning in 1791, Farmer Clark had looked up from the fence he was mending to observe a splendid cortege galloping down on him from the direction of the city of Philadelphia. Outriders thundered in the van, followed by a considerable company of gentlemen on horseback and several great coaches and six. To Simeon Clark's astonishment, the entire equipage stopped before the farmhouse. He began to run. He could hear the creak of springs and the snorting of sleek and sweating horses. Gentlemen and lackeys were leaping to the frozen ground, and by the time Simeon had reached the farmhouse, all were elbowing about the first coach, a magnificent affair bearing a coat of arms. Craning, the farmer saw within the coach a very large, great-nosed gentleman clad in a black velvet suit and a black cloak faced with gold. There was a cocked hat on his wigged head and a great sword in a white leather scabbard at his side. This personage was on one knee, leaning with an expression of considerable anxiety over a chubby lady of middle age, swathed in furs, who was half sitting, half lying on the upholstered seat, her eyes closed and her cheeks waxen under the rouge. Another gentleman, soberly attired, was stooping over the lady, his fingers on one pale wrist. "I fear," he was saying with great gravity to the kneeling man, "that it would be imprudent to proceed another yard in this weather, Your Excellency. Lady Washington requires physicking and a warm bed immediately." Lady Washington. Then the large, richly dressed gentleman was the president. Simeon Clerk pushed excitedly through. "Your mightiness, sir," he cried. "I am Simeon Clerk. We have warm beds, Sarah and I." The president considered Simeon briefly. I thank you, Farmer Clark. No, no, Dr. Craik. I shall assist Lady Washington myself. And George Washington carried his Martha Washington into the little Pennsylvania farmhouse of Simeon and Sarah Clark. And aide informed the Clarks that President Washington had been on his way to Virginia to celebrate his 59th birthday in the privacy of Mount Vernon. Instead, he passed his birthday on the Clark farm, for the physician insisted that the president's lady could not be moved, even back to the nearby capital, without risking complications. On His Excellency's order, the entire incident was kept secret. It would give needless alarm to the people, he said. But he did not leave Martha's bedside for 3 days and three nights. Presumably during those 72 hours while his lady recovered from her indisposition, the president devoted some thought to his hosts. For on the fourth morning, he sent Christopher, his body servant, to summon the Clarks. They found George Washington by the fire, shaven and powdered and in immaculate dress, his stern features composed. I am told, Farmer Clark, that you and your good wife refuse reimbursement for the livestock you have slaughtered in the accommodation for our large company. You're my president, sir, said Simeon. I wouldn't take the money. We wouldn't take the money, your worship, stammered Sarah. Nevertheless, Lady Washington and I would acknowledge your hospitality in some kind. If you give me leave, I shall plant with my own hands a grove of oak saplings behind your house. And beneath one of the saplings, I propose to bury two of my personal possessions. Washington's eyes twinkled ever so slightly. It is my birthday. I feel a venturesome spirit. Come, Farmer Clark and Mistress Clark. Would you like that? What were they? Choked James Ezekiel Patch, the Washington collector. He was pale. Martha Clark replied, the sword at Washington's side, in its white leather scabbard, and a silver coin the president carried in a secret pocket. Silver coin? Breathed Baroness Check, the rare coin dealer. What kind of coin, Miss Clark? The diary calls it a half dime, with an S, replied Martha Clark, frowning. I guess that's the way they spelled dime in those days. The book's full of queer spellings. A United States of America half dime? Asked the Baroness in a very odd way. That's what it says, Baroness. And this was in 1791? Yes. The Baroness snorted, beginning to rise. I thought your story was too impossibly romantic, young woman. The United States Mint didn't begin to strike off half dimes until 1792. Half dimes, or any other U.S. coinage, I believe, said Ellery. How come, Miss Clark? It was an experimental coin, said Miss Clark coolly. The diary isn't clear as to whether it was the Mint which struck it off, or some private agency. Maybe Washington himself didn't tell Simeon. But the president did say to Simeon that the half dime in his pocket had been coined from silver he himself had furnished, and had been presented to him as a keepsake. There's a half dime with a story like that behind it in the possession of the American Numismatic Society, muttered the Baroness. But it's definitely called one of the earliest coins struck off by the Mint. It's possible, I suppose, that in 1791, the preceding year, some specimen coins may have been struck off. Possible, my foot, said Miss Clark. It's so. The diary says so. I imagine President Washington was pretty interested in the coins to be issued by the new country he was the head of. Miss Clark, I want that half dime. I mean, I'd like to buy it from you, said the Baroness. And I, said Mr. Patch carefully, would like to, purchase Washington's sword. The diary, moaned Professor Shaw. I'll buy the diary of Simeon Clark from you, Miss Clark. I'll be happy to sell it to you, Professor Shaw. As I said, I found it in the attic, and I have it locked up in a highboy in the parlor at home. But as for the two other things... Martha Clark paused, and Ellery looked delighted. He thought he knew what was coming. I'll sell you the sword, Mr. Patch, and you the half-dime, Baroness Check, provided... And now Miss Clark turned her clear eyes on Ellery. Provided you, Mr. Queen, will be kind enough to find them. And there was the farmhouse, in the frosty Pennsylvania morning, set in the barren winter acres, and looking as bleak as only a little revolutionary house with a mortgage on its head can look in the month of February. There is an apple orchard over there, said Nicky as they got out of Ellery's car. But where's the grove of oaks? I don't see any. And then she added sweetly, Do you, Ellery? Ellery's lips tightened. They tightened further when his solo on the front door knocker brought no response. Let's go around, he said briefly, and Nikki preceded him with cheerful step. Behind the house there was a barn, and beyond the barn there was comfort, at least for Ellery. For beyond the barn there were 12 ugly holes in the earth, and beside each hole lay either a freshly felled oak tree on its stump, or an ancient stump by itself, freshly uprooted. On one of the stumps sat an old man in earth-stained blue jeans, smoking a corn cob pugnaciously. Tobias Clark? Asked Ellery. Yump. I'm Ellery Queen. This is Miss Porter. Your daughter visited me in New York yesterday. Know all about it. May I ask where Martha is?
Station.
Meeting them there other folks. Tobias Clark spat and looked away at the holes. Don't know what you're all coming down here for. Wasn't nothing under them oaks. Dug 'em all up the other day. Trees that were standing and the stumps of the ones that had fallen years back. Look at one of them holes. Hired hand and me dug down most of China. Washington's Grove, they always called. Now look at it. Firewood. For someone else, I guess. There was iron bitterness in his tongue. We're losing this farm, mister, unless... And Tobias Clark sobbed. Well, maybe we won't, he said. There's always that book Martha found. Professor Shaw, the rare book collector, offered your daughter $4,000 for it if he satisfied it with Mr. Clark, said Nikki. So she told me last night when she got back from New York, said Tobias Clark. 4,000, and we need 12. Well, said Nikki sadly to Ellery, that's that. She hoped Ellery would get into the car and drive back to New York immediately. But Ellery showed no disposition to be sensible. Perhaps, Mr. Clark, some trees died in the course of time and just disappeared. Stumps, roots, and all. Martha, Martha, said the diary doesn't mention the exact number Washington planted here. Look at them holes. 12 of them, ain't there? In a triangle. Man plants trees in a triangle, he plants trees in a triangle. You don't see no place between holes big enough for another tree, do ye? Anyways, there was the same distance between all the trees. No, sir, mister, 12 was all there ever was, and I looked under all 12.
What's the extra tree doing in the center of the triangle? You haven't uprooted that one, Mr. Clark.
Tobias Clark spat once more. Don't know much about trees, do ye? That's a cherry sapling I set in myself 6 years ago. Ain't got nothing to do with George Washington. Nikki tittered. If you'd sift the earth in those holes. I sifted it. Look, mister, either somebody dug that stuff up 100 years ago, or the whole yarn's a Saturday night whopper, which it most likely is. There's Martha now with them other folks. And Tobias Clark added, spitting again, don't let me be keeping ye. It reveals Washington rather, out of character, said James Ezekiel Patch that evening. They were sitting about the fire in the parlor, as heavy with gloom as with Miss Clark's dinner, and that, at least in Miss Porter's view, was heavy indeed. Baroness Check wore the expression of one who is trapped in a cave. There was no further train until morning, and she had not yet resigned herself to a night in a farmhouse bed. The better part of the day had been spent poring over the diary of Simeon Clark, searching for a clue to the buried Washingtonia. But there was no clue. The pertinent passage referred merely to a triangle of oak trees behind the red barn, which His Excellency the President did plant with his own hands, as he had promised me, and then did bury his sword and the half dime for his pleasure in a case of copper beneath one of the oaks, the which, he said, the case, had been fashioned by Mr. Revere of Boston, who is experimenting with this metal in his furnaces. How out of character, Mr. Patch? Asked Ellery. Washington wasn't given to romanticism, said the large man dryly. No fol-de-rol about him. I don't know anything in his life which prepares us for such a yarn as this. I'm beginning to think, but Professor Shaw himself says the diary is no forgery, cried Martha Clark. Oh, the book's authentic enough, Professor Shaw seemed unhappy. But it may simply be a literary hoax, Miss Clark. The woods are full of them. I'm afraid that unless the story is confirmed by the discovery of that copper case with its contents. Oh dear, said Nikki impulsively. And for a moment she was sorry for Martha Clark. She really was. But Ellery said, I believe it. Pennsylvania farmers in 1791 weren't given to literary hoaxes, Professor Shaw. As for Washington, Mr. Patch, no man can be so rigidly consistent. And with his wife just recovered from an illness, on his own birthday, and Ellery fell silent again. Almost immediately he leaped from his chair. Mr. Clark. Tobias stirred from the dark corner. What? Did you ever hear your father or grandfather, anyone in your family, talk of another barn behind the house? Martha stared at him. Then she cried, Papa, that's it. It was a different barn in a different place, and the original Washington's Grove was cut down or died. Nope, said Tobias Clark. Never was but this one barn. Still got some of its original timbers. You can see the date burned onto the cross tree. 1761. Nikki was up early. A steady hack, 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 borne on the frosty air, woke her up. She peered out of her back window, the coverlet up to her nose, to see Mr. Ellery Queen against the dawn, like a pioneer, wielding an axe, powerfully. Nikki dressed quickly, shivering, flung her minked-dyed muskrat over her shoulders, and ran downstairs, out of the house, and around it, past the barn. Ellery, what do you think you're doing? It's practically the middle of the night. Chopping, said Ellery. Chopping. There's mountains of firewood stacked against the barn, said Nikki. Really, Ellery, I think this is carrying a flirtation too far. Ellery did not reply. And anyway, there's something gruesome and indecent about chopping up trees that George Washington planted. It's vandalism. Just a thought, panted Ellery, pausing for a moment. 150-odd years is a long time. For instance, the copper case, breathed Nikki visibly. The roots grew around it. It's in one of these stumps. Now you're functioning, said Ellery, and he raised the axe again. He was still at it 2 hours later when Martha Clark announced breakfast. At 11:30 a.m., Nikki returned from driving the professor, the baroness, and James Ezekiel Patch to the railroad station. She found Mr. Queen seated before the fire in the kitchen in his undershirt, while Martha Clark caressed his naked right arm. Oh, said Nikki faintly. I beg your pardon. Where are you going, Nikki? Said Ellery irritably. Come in. Martha's rubbing lemon into my biceps. He's not very accustomed to chopping wood, is he? Asked Martha Clark in a cheerful voice. Reduce those foul oaks to splinters, groaned Ellery. Martha, ouch. I should think you'd be satisfied now, said Nikki coldly. I suggest we imitate Patch, Shaw, and the Baroness, Ellery. We can't impose on Miss Clark's hospitality forever. To Nikki's horror, Martha Clark chose this moment to burst into tears. Martha! Nikki felt like leaping on her and shaking the cool look back into her perfidious eyes. Here now, Martha. That's right, thought Nikki contemptuously. Embrace her in front of me. It's those three rats, running out that way. Don't worry, I'll find the sword and half dime for you yet. You'll never find them, sobbed Martha, wetting Ellery's undershirt. Because they're not here. They never were here. When you stop to think of it, burying that coin, his sword, if the story were true, he'd have given them to Simeon and Sarah. Not necessarily, said Ellery. The old boy had a sense of history, Martha. They all did in those days. They knew they were men of destiny, and that the eyes of posterity were upon them. Burying them is just what Washington would have done. Do you really think so? Martha sniffled. But even if he did bury them, it doesn't stand to reason that Simeon and Sarah would have let them stay buried. They'd have dug that copper box up like rabbits the minute George turned his back. Two simple country folk, cried Ellery. Salt of the earth. The new American earth. Disregard the wishes of His Mightiness George Washington, first President of the United States? Are you out of your mind? And anyway, what would Simeon do with a dress sword? Beat it into a plowshare, thought Nikki. That's what he'd do. And that half dime. How much could it have been worth in 1791? Martha, they're here under your farm somewhere. You wait. I wish I could believe it. Shucks, child, stop crying. From the door, Miss Porter said stiffly, You might put your shirt back on, Superman, before you catch pneumonia. Mr. Queen prowled about the Clark Acres for the remainder of that day, his nose at a low altitude. He spent some time in the barn. He devoted at least 20 minutes to each of the 12 holes in the earth. He reinspected the oaken wreckage of his axe work, like a paleontologist examining an ancient petrification for the impression of a dinosaur foot. He measured off the distance between the holes, and, for a moment, a faint tremor of emotion shook him. George Washington had been a surveyor in his youth. Here was evidence that the passion for exactitude had not wearied with the years. As far as Ellery could make out, The 12 oaks had been set into the earth at exactly equal distances, in an equilateral triangle. It was at this point that Ellery sat down on the seat of a cultivator behind the barn, wondering at his suddenly accelerated circulation. Little memories were knocking at the door, and as he opened to admit them, it was as if he were admitting a personality. It was, of course, at this time that the sense of personal conflict first obtruded. He had merely to shut his eyes in order to materialize a tall, large-featured man carefully pacing off the distances between 12 points, pacing them off in a sort of objective challenge to the unborn future. The man Washington had from the beginning possessed an affinity for numbers. It had remained with him all his life. To count things, not so much for the sake of the things, perhaps, as for the counting, had been of the utmost importance to him. As a boy in Mr. Williams' school in Westmoreland, he had excelled in arithmetic. Long division, subtraction, weights and measures, to calculate cords of wood and pecks of peas, pints and gallons, and avoirdupois. Young George delighted in these, as other boys delighted in horseplay. As a man, he merely directed his passion into the channel of his possessions. Through his possessions, he apparently satisfied his curious need for enumeration. He was not content simply to keep accounts of the acreage he owned, its yield, his slaves, his pounds and pence. Ellery recalled the extraordinary case of Washington and the seed. George Washington once calculated the number of seeds in a pound troy weight of red clover. Not appeased by the statistics on red clover, Washington then went to work on a pound of timothy seed. His conclusions were 71,000 and 298,000. His appetite unsatisfied, he thereupon fell upon the problem of New River grass. Here he tackled a calculation worthy of his prowess. His mathematical labors produced the great, pacifying figure of 844,800. This man was so obsessed with numbers, Ellery thought, staring at the ruins of Washington's Grove, that he counted the windows in each house of his Mount Vernon estate, and the number of panes in each window of each house, and then triumphantly recorded the exact number of each in his own handwriting. It was like a hunger, requiring periodic appeasement. In 1747, as a boy of 15, George Washington drew a plan of major law, Washington Turnip Field as surveyed by me. In 1786, at the age of 54, General Washington, the most famous man in the world, occupied himself with determining the exact elevation of his piazza above the Potomac's high water mark. No doubt he experienced a warmer satisfaction thereafter, for knowing that when he sat on his piazza looking down at the river, he was sitting exactly 124 feet, 10 and a half inches above it. And in 1791, as President of the United States, Ellery mused, he was striding about right here, setting saplings into the ground, 12 of them in an equilateral triangle, and beneath one of them he buried a copper case, containing his sword and the half dime, coined from his own silver. Beneath one of them. But it was not beneath one of them, or had it been, and had long ago been dug up by a clerk. But the story had apparently died with Simeon and Sarah. On the other hand, Ellery found himself irrationally reluctant to conclude the obvious. George Washington's lifelong absorption with figures kept intruding. 12 trees, equidistant, in an equilateral triangle. What is it? He kept asking himself, almost angrily. Why isn't it satisfying me? And then, in the gathering dusk, a very odd explanation insinuated itself. Because it wouldn't have satisfied him. That's silly, Ellery said to himself abruptly. It has all the earmarks of a satisfying experience. There is no more satisfying figure in all geometry than an equilateral triangle. It is closed, symmetrical, definite, a whole and balanced and finished thing. But it wouldn't have satisfied George Washington for all its symmetry and perfection. Then perhaps there is a symmetry and perfection beyond the cold beauty of figures. At this point, Ellery began to question his own postulates. They found him at 10:30, crouched on the cultivator seat, numb and staring. He permitted himself to be led into the house. He suffered Nicky to subject him to the indignity of having his shoes and socks stripped off and his frozen feet rubbed to life. He ate Martha Clark's dinner, all with a detachment and indifference which alarmed the girls and even made old Tobias look uneasy. If it's going to have this effect on him, began Martha, and then she said, Ellery, give it up, forget it. But she had to shake him before he heard her. He shook his head. They're there. Where? Cried the girls simultaneously. In Washington's Grove.
You found him, croaked Tobias Clark, half rising.
No. The clerks and Nicky exchanged glances. Then how can you be so certain they're buried there, Ellery? Asked Nicky gently. Ellery looked bewildered. Darned if I know how I know, he said, and he even laughed a little. Maybe George Washington told me. Then he stopped laughing and went into the firelit parlor and, pointedly, slid the doors shut. At 10 minutes past midnight, Martha Clark gave up the contest. Isn't he ever going to come out of there? She said, yawning. You can never tell what Ellery will do, replied Nicky. Well, I can't keep my eyes open another minute. Funny, said Nicky. I'm not the least bit sleepy. You city girls. You country girls. They laughed. Then they stopped laughing, and for a moment there was no sound in the kitchen but the patient sentry walk of the grandfather clock and the snores of Tobias from above. Well, said Martha. Then she said, I just can't. Are you staying up, Nicky? For a little while. You go to bed, Martha. Yes. Well, good night. Good night, Martha. At the door, Martha turned suddenly. Did he say George Washington told him? Yes. Martha went rather quickly up the stairs. Nicky waited 15 minutes. Then she tiptoed to the foot of the stairs and listened. She heard an uneasy moan from the direction of Martha's bedroom, as if she were dreaming in an unwholesome dream. Nicky set her jaw grimly, went to the parlor doors, and slid them open. Ellery was on his knees before the fire. His elbows were resting on the floor. His face was propped in his hands. Ellery, what on earth? Nicky, I thought you'd gone to bed long ago. In the firelight, his face was haggard. But what have you been doing? You look exhausted. I am. I've been wrestling with a man who could bend a horseshoe with his naked hands. A very strong man, in more ways than one. What are you talking about? Who? George Washington. Go to bed, Nicky. George Washington? Go to bed. Wrestling with him? Trying to break through his defenses. Get into his mind. It's not an easy mind to get into. He's been dead for such a long time. That makes a difference. The dead are stubborn, Nicky. Aren't you going to bed? Nicky backed out, shivering. The house was icy. It was even icier when an inhuman bellow brought Nicky out of bed with a leap. But it was only Ellery. He was somewhere up the hall in the first glacial light of dawn, hammering on Martha Clark's door. Martha! Martha! Wake up and tell me where I can find a book in this damned house. A biography of Washington, a history of the United States, an almanac, anything! The parlor fire had long since given up the ghost. Nicky and Martha in wrappers and Tobias Clark in an ancient bathrobe over his long underwear stood around shivering and bewildered as the disheveled, demonic Ellery leafed eagerly through a 1921 edition of the Farmer's Factbook and Complete Compendium. Here it is! The words shot out of his mouth like bullets. What is it, Ellery? What on earth are you looking for? He's loony, I tell ye. Ellery turned with a look of ineffable peace, closing the book. That's it, he said. What's it? Vermont. The state of Vermont. Vermont? Vermont? Vermont. What in the crawling creepers has Vermont got to do with Vermont? Said Ellery with a tired smile. Did not enter the Union until March 4th, 1791. So that proves it, don't you see? Proves what? Shrieked Nicky. Where George Washington buried his sword in half dime. Because, said Ellery, in the rapidly lightening dawn behind the barn, Vermont was the 14th state to do so. The 14th. Tobias, would you get me an axe, please? An axe, mumbled Tobias. He shuffled away, shaking his head. Come on, Ellery. I'm dying of cold, tuttered Nicky, dancing up and down before the cultivator. Ellery, said Martha Clark piteously, I don't understand any of this. It's very simple, Martha. Oh, thank you, Tobias. As simple, said Ellery, as simple arithmetic. Numbers, my dears, numbers tell this remarkable story. Numbers and their influence on our first president, who was, above all, a number man. That was my key. I merely had to discover the lock to fit it into. Vermont was the lock, and the doors open. Nikki seated herself on the cultivator. You had to give Ellery his head in a situation like this. You couldn't drive him for beans. Well, she thought grudgingly, seeing how pale and how tired-looking he was after a night wrestling with George Washington, he's earned it. The number was wrong, said Ellery solemnly, leaning on Tobias's axe. 12 trees. Washington apparently planted 12 trees. Simeon Clark's diary never did mention the number 12, but the evidence seemed unquestionable. There were 12 oaks in an equilateral triangle, each one an equal distance from its neighbor. And yet, I felt that 12 oaks couldn't be perfect as the triangle was. Not if they were planted by George Washington. Not on February the 22nd, new style, in the year of our Lord, 1791. Because on February the 22nd, 1791, in fact, until March the 4th, when Vermont entered the Union to swell its original number by one, there was another number in the United States so important, so revered, so much a part of common speech and common living and dying, that it was more than a number. It was a solemn and sacred thing, almost not a number at all. It overshadowed all other numbers, like the still unborn Paul Bunyan. It was memorialized on the new American flag and the number of its stars and the number of its stripes. It was a number of which George Washington was the standard bearer, the head and only recently the strong right arm of the new republic which had been born out of the blood and muscle of its integers. It was a number which was in the hearts and minds and mouths of all Americans. No, if George Washington, who was not merely the living symbol of all this, but carried with him that extraordinary compulsion toward numbers, which characterized his whole temperament besides, had wished to plant a number of oak trees to commemorate a birthday visit in the year 1791, he would have, he could have, selected only one number out of all the mathematical trillions at his command, the number 13. The sun was looking over the edge of Pennsylvania at Washington's Grove. George Washington planted 13 trees here that day, and under one of them he buried Paul Revere's copper case. 12 of the trees he arranged in an equilateral triangle, and we know that the historic treasure wasn't under any of the 12. Therefore, he must have buried the case under the 13th, a 13th oak sapling, which grew to oakhood and sometime during the past century and a half, withered and died, and vanished so utterly that it left no trace. Where would Washington have planted that 13th oak? Because beneath the spot where it once stood, there lies the copper case containing his sword and the first coin to be struck off in the new United States. And Ellery glanced tenderly at the cherry sapling which Tobias Clark had set into the earth in the middle of Washington's Grove 6 years before. Washington the surveyor, the geometer, the man whose mind cried out for integral symmetries, obviously in only one place, in the center of the triangle. Any other place would be utterly and absolutely unthinkable. And Ellery hefted Tobias's axe and strode toward the 6-year-old tree. He raised the axe. But suddenly he lowered it, turned, and said in a rather startled way, "See here, isn't today Washington's birthday?" said Nikki. Ellery grinned and began to chop down the cherry tree.
The President's Half Dime by Ellery Queen and all of the Ellery Queen characters are copyrighted by the Fredericton A. and Manfred B. Lee Literary Property Trust. Music for the podcast is by the Sturbridge Colonial Militia and was obtained from the Community Audio section of the Internet Archive. Editing and mixing for the podcast were done by Jackie Sherbo and Ray Purdom. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, where you'll find more stories like this one, by visiting our website at www.ellerycueenmysterymagazine.com.